Hi, everyone. My name is Maria Cristina. I am happy, joyous, and free and abstinent, and I am thrilled to be here this evening. I'm the speaker chair for the convention, and at this time, I'd like to introduce you to our speaker for this evening. Our speaker is Margie, and Margie hails from Sacramento. Actually, no, she started her recovery in Sacramento. And actually, Margie, I got to know Margie through the phone bridge, and we've known each other, and we've talked for quite some time, and that's one of the many gifts of this program is, and the gifts of having phone bridge meetings and being able to connect with and have relationships and friendships with other compulsive eaters all over the world. So my room is the world. Like, that's my room. That's my home room, the world. Welcome to my world, okay? And so Margie and I have known each other for quite a while, and we met face-to-face this time recently. And Margie exemplifies recovery in action and service in action. She has started meetings and done service in so many different locations, more than in Modesto, right, Kansas City, all over. Wherever she's gone, she's taken her program with her, and she's spread the message and actively made a place for other people to come and find solution. So at this time, I would, rather than me chat some more, I'd like to introduce Margie to you, who has been kind enough, and also she's a delegate. I didn't want to leave that out. She's a delegate as well. So Margie is going to come and share with you this evening her experience, strength, and hope. So please join me in welcoming Margie to the podium.
Hi, everyone. I'm Margie, a compulsive eater. It is really fun to be, oh, Ray, now I know what you mean about looking out at everyone. This is great. And we are beautiful, it's true. Wow. Well, I can tell you that what it was like for me growing up was that food was my comfort from a very early age. I don't know that my childhood was any more or less difficult than anyone else's, but we had our adventures. It wasn't really a practice in my home to express feelings and work through them together. That just wasn't it. We tended to eat or drink something to make ourselves feel better right now. And that made sense to me. I think I was probably born predisposed to being a compulsive eater and turning to things outside myself to make myself feel better. Because I remember very young, I would be at family gatherings and food was available. And, you know, there were some foods that were my favorites and some foods that were not my favorites. But if all my favorites were gone, I'd just go to the next favorite and the next favorite and the next favorite. I didn't really understand that until I met my husband, Bob, and he's a horseman. And he told me horses are preference grazers. I thought, oh, yeah, I can identify with that. They eat what they like the best, then they eat the rest, and then they eat the rest. I like horses. Me too, yes. And so, yeah, as a kid, I really loved the food. I loved the sweets. And I had this one particular memory of being at my great-grandmother's house. And there was a dish of sweets on the coffee table. Now, I can't have been much more than 3 or 4 because I was just tall enough to stretch my arm across the coffee table to get into these treats. And I didn't really like them that much, but I could reach them. And so at first, you know, it's a compliment when you keep going back for more and going back for more. And, oh, isn't that cute? And then I kept going back for more, and I was told no. Well, I didn't like that. I got a resentment right away. You know how we are about someone telling us no with the food. And then when they realized I wouldn't stop even when they told me no, they took the treats and they put them around the corner on a dining room table. Well, they thought I wouldn't be able to reach them, but I saw that chair sitting there. And so I climbed up on the chair and I was reaching over the dining room table to get in those treats. Finally, someone caught on to what I was doing and they took them and they put them on top of the refrigerator. And then I really got a resentment. You know, how dare they not let me have as much as I want? And that just was true for me from the beginning. I always wanted more. And I remember seeing pictures of myself. Remember the, you know, like when you first get your picture and you're in kindergarten, school year pictures. And kindergarten, you know, I was about 4 when I started kindergarten. Age 5, I looked kind of like a normal little cute kid. But something shifted for me in terms of me really relying on the food between ages 5 and age 6. Because all of a sudden, in that second grade picture, I had little cat glasses. Remember the cat glasses? And all of a sudden, my cat glasses were sitting crooked on my face. And my hair was all mussed up. And I thought, boy, that must have been when it kicked in. You know, that must have been when the food addiction really took hold of me. Because I remember for years being the fat kid. That's just who I was. It was my identity. It was like I had a little target on my back walking around school. And I didn't know it at the time. No one told me there was a target back there. But I would shrink from people who would pick on me. And, you know, that negative self-esteem we get from what we do with the food, but also what I did to try to keep getting the food. Because I would lie. I would steal. My mom got to where she would not keep junk food in the house. She just wouldn't do it. Because if there was a holiday coming up where there's supposed to be sweet things in a stocking or a basket or whatever, you know, I would find them. I would climb up on the counters and I would find that stuff. And she would say, "Did you do that?" And I'd deny it. She just could not keep anything like that in the house. And because I was the little human vacuum cleaner. I would steal money from my dad. You know, he had one of those dishes where he put his change, and I'd steal his money. If I was given money for beverages at school or school lunches, when I got old enough, they'd let me go on my own. Boy, the corner store got all my money first thing in the morning, and I consumed all that sweet stuff on the way to school. And there I was left with nothing to eat at school. But it didn't matter. I had to have the fix. It was just the way I lived. And I pretty much went along like that, carrying the extra weight, getting everything I could get whenever I could, until right before high school. And at that point, I also had the desire to get attention from boys. And so I realized something. I had heard this great aunt of mine talk about fasting. And I thought, oh, doesn't that sound cool, you know? I didn't like the idea of dieting, but fasting sounded kind of cool. And I thought, oh, maybe I could do that and I'll lose weight. And then my mom started selling these healthy powdered drinks, this health food stuff. And they said, oh, well, you know, if you have that for 2 of your meals, then you can have 1 meal a day and you'll lose weight. And what I realized with playing around with that is if I starved myself, then I could lose weight. And so in that summer before high school, 3-month period of time, I dropped 30 pounds. So I was, well, let me just say, what I've heard in the program is whenever we start relying on food for emotional comfort instead of actually growing up and dealing with the situations we face, that our emotional maturity just stops. So I was a 6-year-old in a high schooler's body, that now I looked a little more attractive. And I didn't do real well with that. You know, I really, I still wanted to feel better right now. And so I started messing around with other stuff to feel better right now. And I found with the food I could starve myself, and then I could binge on junk food. And, you know, my other friends didn't understand that. They had normal-sized bodies, but they didn't understand why I would eat one of something and I would want more. And I remember the first time a high school friend said something to me about that, and my response wasn't, gee, I don't think I'll do that anymore. My response was, I can't show people what I'm eating anymore. And so that isolation and that pulling away from other people, being afraid of what they thought of me, became very much a part of my life. It had started young, but it just really took hold of me then. And I didn't want anything to get in the way of me feeling better, no matter what it was. I was not good at keeping friends. My older sister, I counted on her to meet all my needs in life. And I counted on one of my parents, my dad, for that for a period of time. And someone would disappoint me, and I'd count on another person to meet all my needs in life. And I would keep dumping one person when they showed a fallacy and moving on to another one. And I wasn't real motivated to do much of anything for myself. I really wanted that other person to be responsible for everything for me. As long as they would do it, I'd let them. You know what I mean? And what this led to for me was only doing as much as I had to get what I wanted. This was a pattern that I just kept living over and over again. And I really wanted to be successful, or at least look that way to other people, so I can have the kind of life I wanted to have. But I really was only willing to do as much as I had to. And so that meant for me that right out of high school, I didn't go into college that I wanted to go to, because I only caught on right before my senior year that, oh, if you want to leave your parents' house and have them pay your way to be somewhere for 4 years where you're basically unsupervised, you have to get good grades. Okay. So then I started working, you know, and I had goofed off in school all that time because why should I bother? But then I got great grades. You know, I went to JC for a year. I went off to college. And there, of course, I'd only wanted to do what I had to do. So I only did the minimal amount I thought I could get by with, and I came that close to not passing. And so I realized, oh, gee, I think I'm going to have to work a little bit harder. And I found out how much I had to do to get by, and I went there. And then I went on to go to law school. I had done just enough to get into the law school I applied for, and they let me in. But when I got there, I didn't think I had to do all that stuff they said you had to do. So naturally, I didn't make it past my first year of law school. And I was really devastated by that. I thought, I don't know what I'm going to do. I focused on pre-law in college. What do you do with that if you don't go to law school? A friend of the family, who was also an attorney, who was also predisposed and active in his addiction, said to me, you can do this. Just go to another school. Go to night school, and you can come work for me. And I found the magic in working for other people who had the same addiction as me. It's amazing what you can get away with when you're hanging out with people who do the same things that you do. Like I said, I was playing with more stuff than just food. And it was familiar. It was what made life possible. It's what made it possible for me to show up each day and try to look good enough and try to be good enough so I could get what I wanted and go home at night and comfort myself. And it was a very isolating kind of life. I would do things and think, oh, if I do this, I'll look like I'm having fun, or I can tell people I did it and it'll seem like I'm having fun. But that was kind of what my life was like. There was the secret, hidden, binging life, and then there was this attempt to look like I'm enjoying my life and I'm successful. And I hit a bottom with some of those other things I was playing around with. At age 29, in 1987, I found help in another support group that uses the books that we use in this program. And putting down those other things I put down to get there, I quite suddenly found myself full-blown in the food again. And I'd been playing with it for years. I had been, you know, doing the food and then doing this and doing that and binging on exercise to try to avoid the consequences for the food and all those other things I was doing. And, you know, from the time I left my parents' house for college, well, I put those 30 pounds on in 1 month, as you can imagine, and I just struggled up and down with that all the way through. But when at age 29, I started getting that help and that other circle of support. My weight just rocketed up. Now, I was really still working because I got a little sense that now that this door has opened for a new kind of life for me, I got to work really hard to make everything perfect right now. I've got to have the perfect job, and I've got to get engaged to the perfect person, and I've got to exercise and make my body perfect, even though there was no way I was going to do that, with the food I was eating. But I was working really hard at it, and what happened was that after 3 years of support that I was getting in that other program, everything fell apart. I was in a car accident because I was a raving food addict, driving madly through Midtown Sacramento. And I got rear-ended. And I was in pain from here to here. Every part of whiplash that could happen was happening for me. The guy I was engaged to, who I thought was going to be the perfect guy, broke off our engagement, but only after I was fired from my job that I was trying to make be perfect too. So within 10 days, all those external things that I thought made me look okay were gone. But not only that, it took the lid off of all the controls I had because I could not exercise. And there was no one around to watch me at night. I didn't know that was a control mechanism. But if someone else was watching me, I was a lot less likely to binge as much. And I didn't have a job I had to get up for. So I'd be up till 3:30, 4 in the morning in front of the TV eating bowl after bowl after bowl of my favorite binge foods. Now, I had gone through all kinds of favorite binge foods. And at that point, I was binging on what I thought were healthy foods. So I thought, if they're healthy, I can have as much as I want, right? But night after night, I got to a place where I could not stop. I would binge so many bowls of food that it'd be up to here. And if I moved the wrong way, it would erupt out of my throat. It was miserable, and I was so full, I would push down on my stomach to try to make room for more because I still hadn't gotten the good feeling yet. I did not know how to find the good feeling anymore. And a friend that I had made in those 3 years before that, she came over to my house. It was the holidays in 1991, and she came over, and, she looked the same to me, except her eyes were really sparkly, and she started telling me really excitedly about this program that she was doing, where she was weighing and measuring her food, and, three meals a day and nothing in between, and all these things we do, and I listened to her for just long enough to say, "Oh, that's nice, but, as soon as I can start exercising again, I'll be fine." And then she gave me the look. The look. The one that says, "Oh, I can see that you're not ready for this now." And I had given people that look. I knew that look. And I thought, "Oh, my gosh, she gave me the look. Let's change the subject, And I binged my way through that holiday season. I humiliated myself over and over again to the point that I didn't have any alternative but to give her a call. And she did meet me at a meeting. It was January 27th, 1992, and I went to my first meeting and started practicing the only program that was around at that point that was like this one that we're doing together today. And I was so willing to work this program, and I was so excited about what I experienced at that face-to-face meeting, because there were people there who were standing up and saying that they had released 100 pounds that I could not imagine that being true. I couldn't even fathom. They were so sparkly and so happy and so full of energy. I just couldn't even imagine it, and there was a whole room full of them. I mean, it was amazing. And when I heard that they use the AA Big Book in the 12 and 12, I thought, well, it worked for me before. It'll probably work again. I got really excited. I got a sponsor, and I got started in the program. And within 3 days, I felt so much lighter. It was like I dropped 30 pounds in 3 days. It was the weirdest feeling. I knew it wasn't possible physically, but I think it was because I wasn't carrying the weight of trying to figure it out for myself anymore. And so I got busy with my first sponsor, and it was about 3 weeks, and all of a sudden she wasn't there when I was calling. And I didn't know what was going on, but I was terrified because I knew I could not do this thing on my own. Of course, I had played the game with her of, you know, one night putting the perfect amount of protein on my scales. And I got so excited. I didn't have to adjust any on or off. I thought, oh, yes, this means I don't have to weigh and measure anymore. Yay! And I told her about this. She says, are you going to do this program or aren't you? And I got so mad at her. Because I was just sure if I was good enough and if I was perfect enough, everything would be wonderful and I could relax and not have to work at this anymore. Well, she put a stop to that. But when she wasn't available anymore, I grabbed on to another sponsor. And when that sponsor wasn't available anymore, I grabbed on to another sponsor. And my life was really taking off. It was interesting because those months before that, I didn't have a job. I was selling furniture to buy my food. You know, I was going into debt to buy food and to binge. And everything started opening up again. Because I could send out resumes during that time I was in the food, but I couldn't follow it up. I couldn't even call to ask them if they got a copy of my resume because I felt so awful about myself. And immediately I get in this program and I can wear more than just my sweatpants. Yeah! It was wonderful. And I started, I started following up on those resumes. I started getting job interviews. And one day, I got the newspaper, because, you know, it was 1992, and I was looking in the I was looking in the newspaper, and I saw an advertisement for a job in Modesto, California. Now, I'd visited there. My parents grew up there. I knew all about Modesto. But I was only 3 months in the program, and I saw this ad. And it was doing the exact same kind of work that I had just gotten fired from not that long ago. And I told myself I was never going to do it again. And I saw that ad, I got so angry. Because I absolutely knew if I applied for that job, I'd get it. And I didn't want to go to Modesto. You know, my meetings were in Sacramento. I couldn't do this on my own. And I was going on and on about this with someone I was talking to, and she says, well, why don't you just call someone there in Modesto and see what's happening? Just call and ask. 3 phone calls later, I found out that a woman had moved from the San Francisco Bay Area and was starting a meeting the night they wanted me to start my job in Modesto. So I went to Modesto, and my first night there, after starting that job, I went to a meeting where she was a sponsor and I was a sponsor, and there were about 20 other people in the room. And I got plunged into service in this program. It was one of those experiences where, you know, it's sink or swim. And I think that was one of the things that really planted service for me, was if I didn't show up and do my part, I might not have meetings. I might not survive in my own recovery. You know, I couldn't just hang out in Sacramento in the wonderful big meetings there and just kind of do a little of this and a little of that. If we're going to have recovery, it's because I'm one of the people showing up and really sponsoring and all those parts of the service that you do. And you know what happened is that fellowship started to grow. Then we had another meeting, and then we had another meeting, and you know, and there's people here, people that I'm still in contact that are weighing and measuring their food in Modesto, California. But But something else happened to me early on. Even though I was practicing law, in that first year of practicing law, I realized that someday I was going to do another kind of work. And I pushed it away. It's like, no, I'm a new attorney. No, 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 I'm not going to become a minister. That's not going to happen. And it would not leave me alone. You know when there's something you know you're supposed to do? It just keeps showing up and showing up. And it did, again and again. And that meant that I was going to move to Kansas City to study. And I moved to Kansas City. And there in Kansas City, they did not have the meetings I needed to have. There was a friend there who used to live here. And many of you may know her, but I'm not going to say her name because I'm going to do good behavior tonight. And she knew that I was going on the phone bridge meetings, and that I had been in that sister program in Modesto that had continued on, even with all the changes that had happened. And I'm really grateful for those phone bridge meetings because they were the ones I was hearing recovery at. But all I could do was read certain things. I couldn't share. I couldn't do service. I couldn't participate. And so this friend who was there, she said, you know what you need to do? You need to call Ray. And she gave me Ray's number without telling Ray she was doing this. And then I called Ray, someone whose name I had heard for years and years and years. And when we were on the phone, she said, I'll tell you what, I'll sponsor you, but only if you start a meeting in Kansas City. Anyone else heard that before here? All right. Yeah, and I did. I started the first meeting. Someone else started the next meeting. Someone else started the next meeting. And there are people in Kansas City today, a fellowship, a thriving fellowship, working the See How program because of that challenge. But you know, I was a California girl. And there was something in me that knew that I was going to return here. And I had the opportunity to serve and, do some really important work while I was there in Kansas City. But the time came when I knew it was time to return also and come back to Sacramento, be closer to where my parents are. And I did that. And so grateful to be back there, so grateful we had two wonderful face-to-face meetings there, and I absolutely knew that those face-to-face meetings were what had kept me alive all those years. And so guess what? I got to start another meeting. Yes. And, it's not always easy to do something like that. But what I do know is that when we do what we know we're supposed to do, even if we don't know the steps from where we are to where we're going, that people and everything shows up to support us in the success. And I started a meeting, and it was the times where I wasn't sure if it was going to work or not. And I was getting discouraged, and there were some times I was sitting there all by myself. But then I started sponsoring someone who, walking around in that community, people could see her recovery as it was happening. And there was something that attracted more people to come to that meeting. And they started attending that meeting. And then other people started coming to that meeting. And now we have a strong, not large, but a strong group that is meeting in my home. Thank you, Ray, for that idea. And one of the people who's come back to the program, has been regularly attending that meeting in my home, is now preparing to start another meeting in Sacramento County. There's a power in what we do. And it's like we read about in the chapter of Vision for You. I remember hearing our co-founder Fred S. say one time about how his sponsor kept making him read A Vision for You over and over again. And he said, oh, not the dreaded A Vision for You assignment. But he read it because he said there's a lot more to it than that last little part at the end. Because it's about having moved through the steps and had the experience we have with that. Now, how do we help create a fellowship where we are? That's the road of happy destiny that we get to trudge together. It's not always easy, but when we do all the parts to our program, we can be attractive to other people who come to that meeting. They can see our recovery. So we're not just reading the stuff at the first part of the meeting and not doing it ourselves. When people are attracted, it's because they can see we're doing it too. And that's one of the things I was reminded of so powerfully this week, being one of the delegates. That's a room full of people who are working their program. Will everyone please stand who served at the World Service Business Conference this week? Please stand. Thank you for your service. Thank you for showing me how to practice the program in a way that I can carry the message that people want to keep coming back and our fellowship can continue to thrive and grow. And what I know is within each, every one of us, there's a divine idea on what is ours to do to carry the message. And if we just do that every day, if we use those seven tools like the spiritual practices that keep us alive, we can't help but thrive and grow. God bless you, friends.